Hello.
Hello.
I think I've met most of you. I'm Erica.
Hi, Erica.
And you are?
Gary.
Hello, Gary.
And Chris.
Hello, Chris. Hey.
So, anyone else is familiar? And we have a visitor, Cheryl Connor. Welcome.
Hello.
So I'll begin with just a very short introduction. Since we record all these and they're online, I'd like to have an identifier at the beginning, so if someone just starts listening to something, they know where it fits. So tonight, this will be the third class in Module 9, and the first class was given by Michael Fagan, called Buddhism Throughout the Ages, How Buddhism Spread Throughout the World.
Sorry, Michael.
I get confused.
She pointed at you.
Right, I pointed at you. I know who you are. Things are I'm a little muddled, you might have guessed. Okay, but anyway, Michael Levin gave that talk, and that's online with Wikipedia arrows, etc. So that was the beginning of that was the origins of Buddhism and how it spread through the areas north and south and mostly east of there. Then the second talk was by the other Michael Fagan, and that's the Vajrayana Buddhism of Tibet, the path of the three yanas. So he covered the three yanas and the historical schools in Tibet. So there's a lot of material in there, but there's also a handout online so you can read and listen as well. So tonight, the topic is American Buddhism, basically how Buddhism arrived here in the West, and particularly in a situation and an opportunity for us to actually make a connection with it. So tonight, this is what we'll be talking about. We won't be talking about every single stream or lineage of Buddhism that came to the West, particularly America, or all the teachers. There are many, many. So we'll try to hit the highlights. So and then the other very important thing is how you particularly connected with Buddhism. And that's actually a big part of the story. So tonight, Erica's going to give a presentation on this. And it'll be fun. There's lots of questions. There's always room for that. Thank you.
So what I find particularly interesting in approaching this little talk is that the Michaels covered 2,500 years of Buddhist history, and I thought, oh, a couple hundred years of American history, Buddhist history would be easy. And I was wrong, and so I have educated myself somewhat about a subject I didn't know so much about. I knew my own experience, but I've discovered some interesting stuff and thought you might find it interesting as well. And I just want to thank Wikipedia, the internet, and a wonderful book that I will mention in a minute. To begin, what I'm really hoping is that it becomes clear that teachings that take place here in this environment are directly connected with the events that came before, and that the essence of the Dharma we study here, Buddha nature, is unchanging through all its manifestations throughout time and place. Here, you actually have received the genuine meditation instruction without fabrication. And every time you sit, we sit, we are meeting the mind of the Buddha, which is our own minds in an open state, encountering glimpses of the present moment. So that this primordial open ground of nowness is not owned by any ism and is without bias or allegiance and is always the same. And it's also the birthright of every human being, which is why it does speak across time and place, even to America. So there's a quote at the beginning of a very wonderful book, which I really recommend you get. It's called When the Swans Came to the Lake. I don't know if any of you have encountered this book.
We'll put it online, too, yeah, in case you forget. The title will come.
It's by Rick Fields, who was also a student of Chögyam Trungpa Rinpoche, who was our guru. And it's the book is a really extensive exploration of America, American Buddhism, and the paths that brought Buddhism to America. The quote that is at the very beginning of the book is lovely, and it's where the title of the book comes from. It was in the Boston Globe in December 10th of 1976. When the 16th Karmapa first came to America. And the Karmapa, here it is, the Karmapa told an interviewer this week that he came to the United States because the teachings of the Lord Buddha had preceded him. If there is a lake, he said, the swans would go there. So what he's talking about is that there was already movement and interest in the Buddha Dharma that had already been established, and is what draws the teacher. It's the curiosity and interest of the students that draws the teacher to a time and a place. So American Buddhism has established itself with particular strength in the last 45 years. But the origins began quite a bit before, as you can imagine. And in researching this paper, I discovered a wonderful human being whose name is William Jones. He was an 18th century British lawyer and linguist, and apparently an extraordinary guy. Emily says that he knew 29 languages?
Yeah, 28 languages.
28 languages.
He taught himself.
Yeah. He wrote some extraordinary translation of when he was 15 years old. The king of France wanted him to make a translation of something. And he, was it the king of, yeah.
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah, and first he was hesitant, and I think his pride kind of got caught up in there. But when he was 15, so this was an unusual and extraordinary guy in the beginning. And at the time, he was described as harmonious. He had a harmonious personality by his peers. So he was eventually posted to India and became very, very interested in the Eastern philosophies and religions and art. And already in Europe, there was an early Jesuit translation of Confucius, and apparently he was considered by Europeans as sort of the noble sage, which was sort of a name we see repeated a lot, that the East was a mystical and knowing place with sages who could reveal the world to you. So Jones was taken by this Eastern philosophy, and there he was in India, in the Orient, and he really thought that the West could have much to learn from what he described as an Oriental Renaissance. He translated Hafiz and Rumi, and those translations were popular in America. He met and became friends with Benjamin Franklin, and his work came to influence Emerson and Thoreau and the Transcendentalists. An interesting aside is that he really, apparently, really, he and Benjamin Franklin were really close. They really appreciated each other. And there was some hesitation. And he supported a less aggressive response to the American revolution, to
from Britain.
Mm-hmm. And Britain was a little nervous to send him to India because India was beginning to undergo its own revolution. So that was kind of interesting.
A lot of radical.
Yeah, they were nervous, but and it was he, according to the book, When the Swans Came to the Lake, Thoreau first came into contact with his writings in Emerson's library in Concord. And in 1844, he included Jones's translation of the Lotus Sutra in an issue of the Dial, which was the Transcendentalists' literary journal. So that was the sort of undercurrent that was cooking in America. But the first sort of cultural Buddhists arrived in America with the building of the railroads. They were Chinese immigrants, and most of them settled in the West, in California. And at the same time, Japanese Buddhists arrived, who primarily went to Hawaii and in some places in California as well to work on plantations. So that they imported Zen Buddhism. So those were two sort of cultural transplants of religious practice in America. And they also established churches and temples throughout the West. In 1893, the Chicago World's Fair hosted a conference, which was the World Parliament of Religions, which included a Japanese Zen master and three of his students, including D.T. Suzuki, who remained and established Zen practice in America as well. So the landscape began to change in the 50s and 60s, as more Zen teachers arrived, including Mizumi Roshi, who founded Zen Center in Los Angeles, and Suzuki Roshi, who founded San Francisco Zen Center. And many other Zen practitioners came. At the same time, American youth culture, and I was one of them, I suspect some of you here as well, started to become quite disenchanted with, actually really disgusted with the power structure that brought us the Vietnam War and embedded racism and a kind of airless legacy of the suburbs. And
how does she really feel about
this? I have a view of it for you. It's okay.
Those were the good old days.
And what was happening? We were connecting with, that was also happening with certain, with writers, with beat poets, with Ginsberg and Kerouac and others. Alan Watts, do any of you remember Alan Watts?
Yeah.
Okay. He was a last Zen priest, among other things. He himself has an extraordinary history. Wrote books and poetry, and he had a radio show that lasted actually for 9 years.
Mm-hmm.
But you can, till 1962, 1963, 1962, and you can still get, I think you probably, well, anyway, you can definitely.
On TV.
Yeah, I'm sorry?
He was on TV in the Bay Area.
And radio as well, yeah. Yeah.
First was radio, probably.
Yeah.
You start with, what is the sound of one hand clapping?
Right, right. So you were, that's where you were living, right?
Yeah.
So that was our sort of a more widespread introduction to a Buddhist view, and it kind of connected with the hippie generation. I truly hate that expression, but I don't know what else to say. I'm
the '60s.
Those of us who are experiencing the zeitgeist of the '60s, but much quicker to say the hippie generation, I suppose.
Going back to the beginning of the 20th century.
Yeah.
So Buddhism was practiced basically by some Chinese and Japanese who had immigrated.
Right.
But it had not yet spread
right.
to any of the Anglo culture at all.
Well, there were, and you all probably know more about this than I do, but there were some Westerners who would travel to the East.
Senzaki was very important in Los Angeles.
Mm-hmm.
He found the Zen Center there.
Guys who did that
and that was right, in the 1930s.
Right.
And so that was the first Zen center that actually interacted with Anglos as opposed to only Japanese.
And then there were the occasional Westerner who would travel
to
the Orient,
uh-huh.
you know,
right.
and sort of would be fascinated by the culture.
Well, that was huge in the late 19th
yeah,
century.
Yeah.
But I'm just wondering how did anyone outside of Japanese or Chinese Americans who settled here become real devoted practicing Buddhists in the early part of the 20th century who were not from Asia?
Well, Alan Watts became a Zen priest, but he's a little later than that.
Aldous Huxley was. There were a lot of people in Los Angeles who played with, and then you had theosophy, which was a whole other trip.
Right.
Which theosophy had two fundamental sections, and the most famous one was the Buddhist Sangha. There's another kind of Christian section, but theosophy was tremendously important. All these bigwigs, it became a thing to become a theosophist. Henry Ford, you know, all the great industrialists, and the headquarters for the Theosophical Society, the secret headquarters, was in Ojai, California.
I didn't know there was a secret headquarters.
They were really leaning to the egolessness dimension. I mean, heading towards that, at least in terms of their impulses. Nobody practiced, of course. Nobody had any idea what meditation was.
That's your question.
If that's what you're asking.
What were they practicing?
Really. I mean, that fills in the blank there.
If people went to India or to Tibet, a few people went to India and they did actually engage with teachers. There's a famous painter, Nikolai Rurik, who was.
Wait, don't get off this. We have a question here.
Yeah.
The triggered another sort of a general question, which is that Buddhism as practiced in Asia tends to be more of a alms and you know not as much individual practice that is left to the monasteries, and it seems that there's been something of a shift in the way that the Buddhism is adopted in the West. And did that come about from the? I'm curious as to when that shift happened, going from giving alms to the monks to becoming a practitioner oneself.
Well, Zen practice was mostly practiced by people, by priests and so on and so forth. So I don't know about Japanese Buddhism, but Tibetan Buddhism. That is true. I mean, it was mostly practiced in the monasteries and supported by the culture around it. When did it shift? I don't know.
Well, when it came here, what happened then?
Yeah, I think, I know that in Thailand that young men often enter the monastery for a couple of years, but there's not as much of a practice of meditating every day.
Well, I don't think, in my knowledge, that really didn't start happening until Zen practice really established itself here and Tibetan practice to start.
Among Westerners.
Among Westerners,
I think that's
right.
Yeah.
Sorry?
Tupton said that.
Yeah.
We meditate whole lot more than
right.
we do.
Right.
Right. Yeah, I think that is the distinction, and that's one thing I think Erica's going to highlight in the talk is the container here in the West and how it was different in terms of the way people connect.
Go for it.
Oh, no, go ahead. No, please, discussion.
Discuss.
I'm back in the 60s, guys, right. So
I'm with you there.
Okay. So I wanted to also, I'm getting back with a sort of, it sort of seemed as though a generation, it's interest in Eastern thought swept my generation. You know, those people who grew up in the 50s and 60s and there was a sort of like a whole invasion of, do you remember there was a whole invasion of Hindus? And
yeah, I was going to say,
yeah.
Hare Krishna.
Yeah, that was what we were
thinking. Yeah,
that,
huge influence on me. Huge.
Really?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, that's actually a really interesting discussion, because each one of us was brought here
I think it was
through our own
Ram
personal
Das.
Path.
A little Alan Watts, but Ram Dass really was... Yeah.
Interesting to note that Timothy Leary lived on my street where I grew up in Newton.
We're talking, maybe not all know who we're talking.
Timothy, people here?
Baba Ram Dass and Timothy Leary. Because Ram Dass was his partner in crime.
At Harvard. At Harvard, they were researchers.
LSD.
Richard Alpert, yeah.
LSD.
Yeah.
LSD.
And that was really interesting. My sister was his son's girlfriend, and my father was horrified. So that was a long time ago, far out of place. But anyway, so that was what was sort of the underground that was cooking this interest in Eastern thought. And then the Chinese invasion of Tibet brought Trigam Trungpa and other lamas to the West. Vajrayana Buddhism, and he eventually founded Vajradhatu, which became over time Shambhala, which were very committed practice paths of Tibetan Buddhism. So actually the four of us are kind of living
Dinosaurs.
That's what I was thinking. But what almost came to mind, you know, that's this is our path we're talking about. So it's very interesting. So yes, the containers of Buddhism in America are varied. There's the Zen approach, which reflects its Japanese origins of discipline and form. It's the black and white. And then they've brought the Zen arts of Ikebana, of archery, of martial arts, and tea ceremony. You could study with Vipassana teachers, Joseph Goldstein, who founded Insight Meditation, mindfulness-based stress reduction, and program with Jon Kabat-Zinn. Some of you may be familiar with that. And Herbert Benson at Mass General Hospital introduced meditation techniques and yoga techniques in the medical environment, common medical practice. And currently now, the traditional Tibetan forms certainly do continue. They're more colorful, ceremonial, mantra and visualization techniques. And there's not so much of the traditional monastic forms because very few of us would be able to complete the 3-year retreat. And we have families and jobs. So becoming a lay practitioner has sort of become the American face of Buddhism. Mm-hmm. And every one of us is the face of that. Our own practice is American Buddhism. there are the issues of women in Dharma have become very important, that women at the highest levels of Buddhist teaching, that's a step away from the sort of traditional male-dominated structures of Zen and Tibetan Buddhism. You could study with Khandro. Some of you also studied with Khandro Rinpoche during the program she did here, Pema Children. And there's also something called Engaged Buddhism. I don't know if you're familiar with that as well. The Prison Dharma Network, Fleet Mall, is involved with bringing Buddhist practice to prisons. And that's a very successful program, a very important program. Also, work on the environment. So it isn't just... When we were first began, there was this sort of sense of there's you and your cushion in your on your path. And in the last, I'd say, 15 years, the approach has really expanded hugely. Yoga studios proliferate. Children are being taught meditation practice in schools. So there's a real sense of this path invading sort of ordinary contemporary life. I remember a time when it was a very odd thing to do, to what is it, stare at your navel.
Right.
Right? You know, it's like, what are you doing? And now it's entered our common parlance. So I just wanted to finish by saying that how Buddhism has migrated into this culture it's our direct connection with the people of the past who had the same kind of awareness as that we did. That what brought us into this room, what brought every one of us to the meditation cushion was there was a personal sort of moment of awareness that it was important, necessary to work with your mind. And this same inspiration goes back 2,500 years to the Buddha and is the same message that's taught from one teacher to student to teacher to student throughout history. And you are now part of that history, part of that stream. So I thought it would be really interesting to sort of talk about what brought... How did any of us end up in this room? Talking about something that doesn't make money, it doesn't add up, it's not a credential, but it's something that really... you can't ignore. So I thought I'd open the floor.
I think for my generation, Dalai Lama has become a household term.
Yeah.
And really gave a face to what Buddhism is and the books that he's written, particularly for lay people, about happiness and talking about suffering and such. Most of the people I know who do not consider themselves Buddhists have taken the time to actually read at least passages, if not entire book by him. Mm-hmm. So it's interesting to me that him leaving Tibet really brought a big, much bigger awareness, I think, to the rest of the world, particularly to my generation. When I was in, I went to Syracuse.
I didn't. I just went to Georgia. My sister did.
When I was at Syracuse, I got to see the Dalai Lama speak in a rather small... I mean, nowadays he fills up massive Twitter center.
Football.
When I went to see him, he was in a small theater.
Right.
And, you know, I was sitting probably from here to that wall away from him. And I remember going to listen to him and just being really moved by his story and just how approachable he seemed and not mysterious. He seemed very like, kind of like somebody I might meet someday and sit down and chat with. And that suddenly made this whole idea of Buddhism much more approachable for me. And that was, and at different points in my life, Buddhism kept knocking on my door. Mm-hmm. And it was only until recently, like a year or two ago, that it really started banging hard on my door. But throughout my life, starting in high school, when I had a high school science teacher, or a social studies teacher, who said, I'll give you 5 extra points on your final grade if you do a paper on Zen Buddhism. Because he knew I was in martial arts.
Wow.
And
wow.
I was a troublemaker in school. And so that 5 extra points made a big difference in my grade.
Wow.
So I agreed to it. So I wrote a 10-page paper on Zen Buddhism.
How lucky that
wow.
you got.
Yeah.
Or you'd say, how great the karma that
yes.
got you.
Yeah. I'd love to look them up and say, guess what?
Wow,
guess what?
What
a difference.
So there have been a number of things like that. But I think the Dalai Lama, for just for that massive presence, omnipresence now in society for the term Buddhism and the basic concepts has been major, especially on the internet. I mean, he has such a huge, his Facebook presence is massive.
Big.
It's massive. And the memes that keep going around with him. So even my
as he does.
He has a Twitter account.
Oh wow.
My kids' friends all quote him and know him and pass him.
Really?
Oh yeah, because he's what you call a meme. So there are
right.
photos of him with quotes, and sometimes the quotes aren't his. But that's okay.
So
many memes. There are many of them. Yes.
Meme.
And these get shared across, and then people go, really cool saying, and then they share it among other people, and so he has definitely done a good job of infiltrating the internet. I think it's just people. Oh, sure, it is. It's just people quoting him,
right?
But still,
but what you're saying is that they're quoting him because he reaches them.
It's
yeah. something
what
that
he's
really
saying
yeah.
touches them.
Yeah,
yeah. And we were just talking about this when we came in. You know how kids today are not buying cars.
Yeah, that's right.
And they're,
right.
There's also been some interesting movement towards these generations growing up where they're investing less money in things and more money in experiences.
Right.
And such now is that wedding registries, you buy an experience for a couple instead of a thing.
Instead of stuff.
Which I just think is a great commentary about where we should be going. So
that's great.
That's wonderful.
I don't think my nieces and nephews have bought them.
Oh yeah.
They're definitely still in the things. And lots of them.
Mm. Notice also that the Dalai Lama did not set out to be a TV personality or to make himself famous.
Right. Kind of pushed into that.
I guess to tell my story of how I ended up being here, just thinking back of, it's so funny because I was brought up in Universalist Church, but one thing we didn't do, we did a thing called Church Across the Street, but we never did go to a Buddhist temple.
Church what?
Church Across the Street.
That's
what they called it back, religious education, when I was a teenager. And we visited different churches, just so we knew what a Jewish temple was, Mormon, spiritualists, contact of the dead and all that, but we never had a Buddhist temple. But anyways, I digress. But I think one of my first experiences with Buddhism was we went to General Assembly. We were delegates of this church going to GA down in Charlotte, North Carolina in 93, and I remember taking a Zen Buddhist workshop, and I was really drawn to it, and it just, you know, it just, I liked it, and I liked the whole thing with the fruit and stuff that they have in the altar in the front. And just also just thinking of the experiences of going to Hawaii, that was in 08, going to a Buddhist temple there. Actually, went the year before, we went to a Buddhist temple, but it was we just kind of went to the temple instead of going to a service. We actually went to a service on the Big Island. And that was really my really first taste of the Buddha, and I really I liked a lot. So I think when, you know, searching this out, you know, meditation, and then Michael and Emily, you know, decided to create this group, it's like, it just seems so serendipitous that it all worked out, that, you know, it happened to be right down the street, that, you know, to have this place come to us, like I had to drive hours and hours away to get to do a, you know, to do meditation. So it's really, I feel very blessed that this happens, you know, this community is here. And also because of the familiarity of this community, because of being a member of this church for many years.
Did you, what the service that you talk about that you went to in Hawaii, was it, what was it? Was it sitting meditation?
Someone was speaking, I think, as I remember, they were speaking, and everybody was just sitting, and they were speaking, and I forget if, was he speaking in Tibet? Yeah. Whatever language they speak.
So this was a Tibetan?
Yeah.
I see.
Yeah.
With a translator.
With a translator, right.
And we were seated, one question.
Yeah. So it was really, it was a great, great experience. It just really kind of opened my mind up to the whole thing. And then seeing goats on roofs of cars, you know, they kind of, you know, afterwards kind of, you know, cemented in my mind.
Seeing goats?
No, there's some goats that were up walking up on top of cars and stuff. And just a weird thing that I've never seen before, so.
Okay, I thought it was even weirder than that. I thought you said seeing ghosts on roofs.
No,
of course.
Yeah.
So.
Goats. No ghosts.
Yeah.
But also, just one more thing, just to, I've also, you know, I felt very, it was a great experience, was going to Newton Andover Theological and seeing,
He was there.
Was it last year?
Yeah, last year. Yeah. And that was really just great, just to be in the presence of someone that's, mm-hmm. you know, so there. Mm-hmm. You know.
So it's really interesting how it sort of penetrates you, and all of a sudden it's important to you. From nowhere, all of a sudden, it becomes important that you actually find you make time to be on the cushion. You make time to be someplace. And how does that happen? That you go from just wandering around doing your life to moving to making something significant in your life.
Yeah, to build off of what Gary was saying. I do feel like as well too that I bumped into the group. How I actually came across Buddhism was very random. I was not looking. I just happened to walk into a Blockbuster one day, and I was having a crummy day, and there was a poster and it had a quote that was attributed to Buddha, and it just really resonated with me. And after I didn't know who Buddha was, I didn't know anything about Buddhism, I started reading just some of the quotes that were attributed to him. I started to read them, and then there was a sign somewhere where I came in where ordinarily I would be exercising, but I got a back injury. I came in, and the class happened to be talking about kleshas, and that really took it to the next level, because we just started deconstructing the ego, which I read about Buddhism and a lot of the great things that were attributed and pacified a lot of the feelings that we had. But then when we started going to non-self, that just took it to another level. And then ever since then, it's almost like every day is introspection on there's no one there. I mean, the renunciation of everything that was important, business, I still have the same core of people that I've had before in my life. It's just, I experience them different. I love them, and everyone goes in their own path, but I do feel very lucky, like Gary said, as if it was totally random.
You could say it's totally random, and then you could say everything that you did up to that point in your life led you to that moment.
There's no escape from cause and effect.
Right.
But
you kinda,
the thing about it is, I feel like I'm still just scratching the surface because I just can't get over.
Yeah.
I can't get over myself, you know. I mean, it's the. It's funny because the first book actually that Michael had recommended to me, that was just bunker buster. It's the very reason why people, spiritual materialism, the very reason why people actually even follow stuff is to appease their ego, and then you really look at and you question why you do things, and you start to just open up, and you see this very same things that you saw in the past, kind of almost more with a different lens, you know.
What book was that, out of curiosity?
That was Cutting Through Spiritual Materialism, and actually I just opened up to a section and I felt like that section was speaking to me, and that was totally, you know, fortunate, very fortunate. So
I think that's an experience that we both share. Because when you're open to see, the world speaks to you. And you kind of get out of your own way. You stop your mental chatter enough to actually see what's presenting itself to you. The path sort of starts leading you along, actually. That's fantastic. Thank you so much.
And Kim, I was thinking about my husband's a person who often something like almost catastrophic will happen to us, and he'll find somebody who helps us tremendously. I thought, oh, he must be amazing because he does that. And really, he's open to accepting help from people and asking for help. And most of us don't do that. Most of us only say, I'm not going to let you help, you know. So it's that piece of
open. Pride gets in the way.
Hearing, open to help. I mean, so the story that I don't know if everybody knows is that I had been doing some meditation and had gone to the Sangha at a church in West Newton, and then the teacher went off on like a 9-month retreat, and there weren't enough people coming. He said, no, we're just closing down. It was kind of sad. And I was like, oh, it'd be nice to have one. And then Emily and Michael came to visit the church, because they were thinking they might want to move to Waltham, and Emily has long story about it. And then, someone at the church said, met them and said, oh, you want to have a meditation? Well, someone would like that. And like the week before, we talked about, what if we really need to have one here?
Wow.
And Emily walked in.
Yeah.
Wow. So again, it's that piece of a person being willing to offer, and someone sitting there and saying, I'm looking for
I'm
ready to listen. Yeah. And I think that piece is, sort of that, that there's all kinds of people out there waiting to help you and share things with you. We spend a lot of time, so busy with my little stuff. I don't have time to hear.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think we have to be ready too, because I think of my family and like one sister that off and on she asked me to teach her to meditate, and I've done everything from having her lying on the floor to everything I can think of, and nothing really sticks. And so it's a very karmic thing, I think. You know, like there's a point for some of us, we just go, I've got to figure this out. I've got to look at my mind and understand. And, you know, for other people, maybe they just don't connect with this. Maybe there's another way they find. But it's, I think it's really interesting how sometimes there's just that click that happens.
I remember seeing a quote that said, openness plus opportunity equals luck.
Mm. Yeah, the openness.
Well, you're lucky. Opportunity, and I was open to it.
Right. That's a very good point.
Do you know the phrase we use then? Auspicious coincidence. Mm-hmm. Tender on to bed.
About 30 years ago, I read the book that the Tibetan book of Living and Dying, and I became very interested in Buddhism. I traveled in a lot of Buddhist countries in the world, and but I was drawn here for the meditation aspect, and I thought, well, Buddhism is a very I was drawn to it because I thought it was very simple. You know, you read the Four Noble Truths. That seems very simple. And the longer I stay here, the more complicated and more
involved.
Not difficult it is to but every week, you know, I become a little more confused. So my original theory is thrown out the window. But I keep coming back,
I guess that's part of it.
Maybe not in this lifetime I'll get it, but you know, maybe sometime I will.
What is it that makes it complicated?
Well, sometimes it seems to get more involved than there's more thinking involved in it than I'm used to in a religion.
That's beautiful.
There's so many different kinds of Buddhism, and you know, there's some.
One is enough for me.
Right? What I'm saying is, some are more intellectual. Some of the explanations may be intellectual, and others will just say, "Sit in the woods and watch your mind." Yeah. So, just like there's a million kinds of Judaism and a million kinds of Christianity, and there's a million kinds of Buddhism at this point.
But it's complicated because our mind is complicated.
Yes.
And if that wasn't so, we wouldn't need it.
Yeah, there was a quote keeps coming up in this discussion. It was something I heard at an AA meeting years ago, which is that I think of my mind as a dangerous neighborhood, and I don't like to go in there alone. And having had sobriety forced on me at age 26, I became aware at an early age of how thinking really wasn't my friend in many ways. And that having computer science career and all that hadn't actually allowed me to make it made some very bad decisions, and my mind had been there all the time. And I've been interested in Buddhism as the best explanation of why I think what's wrong with people, basically. I've accepted it intellectually for a long time, and probably started having a practice about 2 years ago, because basically everything in my life is actually pretty good right now, and I don't think it's the way to bet that that will be the way forever. And I'd like to have some resources as to deal with, aging, death, change, all that stuff.
Yeah. That's kind of the whole ball of wax right there. Yeah, wonderful. Yeah. I know when I first realized that thinking was an issue, And that I was never going to resolve my problems by thinking about them. That it was a huge relief, actually. And that I realized that everybody's walking around with the same kind of, you know, mental, being attacked mentally, and that the only way out of it was for me was to do meditation practice, to sort of not be attached to the thinking process itself. Yeah, that was really great. Yeah,
I think what this class has brought tonight for me too, and I forget which one of the teachers had it, but neurosis, not just from the standpoint of the medical condition, but what we all go through consistently, and
quality of mind.
It really does help you understand and have compassion for everybody, because you know it in yourself, you know that other people are going through it. It's a great understanding. It helps you, transcend a lot of things, because you catch yourself, you get outside of your shoes, and hey, this is really silly.
Yeah.
Wonderful. We're all
neurotic. Exactly.
And we also all have Buddha nature.
Yeah.
We also are, every single one of us has compassion, and we're sort of igniting the compassion part and connecting with our own Buddha nature. And everybody has it, even the idiot who cut you off in traffic, So you can watch your mind react habitually, right, with aggression or whatever, and then your sense of compassion kicks in, which is kind of revolutionary.
Actually, I had read a great quote that resonated with me recently by Rick Hansen. He's got some good stuff. I don't know what type of Buddhism. I try to stick to the essence of it. But he said, remember that just like you, this person wants to be safe, free, safe, happy, and free of suffering. And if you just think about that, regardless of what their approach is, then we all want that.
Yeah.
It just gives you clarity.
Huge. Yeah. It's interesting talking about these origin stories, because we each have them. We sort of tripped over Buddhism and it knocked on the door and said, hi. It's sort of, we had to slog through the mud of our own experience to want to work with this, to say, space. I can actually make friends with myself and the environment that I find myself in. It's almost like we earned it, dare I say.
Mm-hmm. Well, there were many streams to my path. Maybe one of the first ones, I'm not sure, but I did a 10-week workshop, a Herbert Benson meditation workshop at UMass Boston. So I think I came to it that way. I'm not sure. I think it's always been there for me. I always felt like I was a spiritually connected to something, but Catholicism just didn't do it for me. And then I sort of drifted for a while, and then when we went to that workshop that Gary was talking about earlier, for me, what connected and what resonated with me was the animal spirituality, and I didn't set out to become a vegetarian, but that's what put me immediately on the path to vegetarianism, which later I found out, this is connected. Many Buddhists are also vegetarian, and so I just had all these little streams that kind of led me onto this bigger river that I feel like I've stepped back into, stepped in and out, and I'm back in right now to see where it carries me. But it is, I really appreciate everything that everybody said, because I can relate to everything, and pieces of what everybody said, I connect to those practices. You know, the quiet mind and getting out of my mind and finding a friend in my mind. It's peaceful.
Yeah, I was curious. I mean, I'm relatively new to this group. Is a capsule version of the origin story for the teachers? I assume you've already told your stories many times.
Actually, no.
Well, there's a little bit on the website, but not this piece.
Right. I'd love to hear the, you know, in particular, that since all of you are following the same teacher, you know, how what brought you to that teacher? If that's the right question.
Well, it has to be a condensed form, but we could just
some
say a few things.
We each do have a story, no doubt.
That's true. We would have to leave you out anyway.
But we will do that. We should definitely do it. We won't drop that.
Okay, thank you.
Definitely. And where we make a connection.
I guess, I never really think about the very beginning of the story for myself, and I'll just mention it in 5 seconds. But when I was very young, my mother got cancer, and she died when I was 17. And so seeing her dead, and I was the only one that got to go in the room. My brothers and sisters weren't allowed in. And I went in with my father. And I think that was the moment I realized, my God, you know, this is real. So what is it all about? This is it. And I was very young, and this is Delaware. I mean, as I figured out, there probably was never a Buddhist book in Delaware for at least another 20 years. But, I think for me, it was such a profound experience that I just started searching, and I didn't know even what I was looking for. I had no idea what I was looking for, no idea. But I ended up then leaving Delaware and coming to Boston. That's how I got here. A friend of mine lived here, and I said, can I come and stay with you? And she said, sure. And it was the hippie world. And, you know, it was the beginning of connecting with teachers and getting myself into a situation where there was a possibility of meeting the Buddha, the Buddhist teachings.
I got it right.
The Buddha was here. The Buddha's in here. So anyway, I'll leave it at that. But I realize when we're talking, you know, there's the superficial level, and then there's like there's something very deep for all of us. I think it's could be a wounding. It could be anything that there's a question brought up, like what is this? So I'll leave it at that.
Shall I wait for another time? We're a little over time.
You can say something.
Oh,
go ahead.
Well, it's really hard to find the beginning of the beginning of the beginning, of course, but what led me directly to Buddhism was feeling completely fucked up and confused and not knowing how to get outside of my own mind. And I was on a flight to Europe, and this Indian fellow called me aside and said, come sit here. And the fellow sitting next to him moved away. And he said, it is indicated that you come to my camp. I said, oh, really? And I said, what do you do there? He said, oh, we dance and sing. And I thought, well, that's kind of interesting. And then I ran into him again in Luxembourg, and he said, yes, it's indicated that you come to my camp. Which was in Chamonix in France. And it turned out that he was Pierre Vilayat Khan. He was the head of the Sufis at the time. So I was searching, and he clearly picked up on the vibe.
Yeah.
And so I continued on my travels, and I was hitchhiking in a car going up north, and then we drove past France. By France, and we kept going. And just as did you describe, or you describe, I think, I was in a tent with, I was homeless basically traveling, and I was in a tent in the Crystal Palace camping ground outside of London, feeling terribly awful and miserable, and that, like, I was pretty much going to be crazy for the rest of my life. And this, there was a knock on the little tent post. And this girl said, "Hey, anybody driving up to Scotland? There's a Buddhist monastery there." And I said, "We'll hitch." And I landed at Sami Ling, which was the Tibetan Buddhist monastery where Chögyam Trungpa had just left.
How old were you?
I was 21. Yeah. Well, that was the second time. The first time I landed at Holy Ole Nydahl's place in Copenhagen. So I needed two times of auspicious coincidence before I got it. You know, but I got it. And every time I let go of the sense of when I finally realized that I was alive, the earth was going to hold me up. If as long as I was alive, I would be somewhere. Boom! I landed in a Dharma. I landed in a Tibetan Buddhist Dharma environment.
Wow.
So that's how I picked up the message, by being hit over the head a couple of times.
The cosmos had to knock.
Yeah, bada boom. Yeah. So similar.
I don't want to tell my story, but I'm going to add a fragment of it you brought up. So I've never met Pir Vilayat Khan, but I certainly met his American student, Sam Lewis.
Oh, yeah.
No kidding. That was a student.
I know that name.
I didn't realize
that. Yeah. Okay. Sam Lewis.
Now, wait, this is Michael. She's on a date.
I don't know him anyway.
Who are you talking about?
Yeah.
You never met who?
Sam.
Pir Vilayat Khan, she mentioned.
Pir Vilayat Khan was the son.
Wait.
Two famous. Yeah.
I'm in the middle of a story, Michael.
I want to know.
Yeah.
Okay. She mentioned Pir Vilayat Khan. She met him on the plane, right?
Yeah.
You said you're going to enter my tent.
But I didn't know who he was. So
okay. He's a great Sufi pastor, famous, incredibly famous one. Okay. I met his American student, Sam Lewis, known as Sufi Sam, an American Jew.
Sufi Sam.
And an absolute, kind of a crazy wisdom person, like Trungpa maybe. And he had a great influence on me, but I'm not going to go further than that.
Very interesting. Yeah. Very interesting. Sufi Sam.
Okay, one quickie. Okay. Only because you brought up Sam Lewis. I was, Sam Burkholz and I, who started Shambhala Publications, were buddies, and we started hanging out with this really nutty guy who called himself the exponent of Yamabushi Buddhism, which is a thing where people walk over coals and all this kind of stuff, and they go out in the mountains. So we were climbing mountains and doing all this. But he said, "You guys got to really meet the guru." So he took us to meet Joe Miller, who was a, you could say, Dharma brother of Sam Lewis. Sam would live a good part of his time, spend a good part of his time in San Francisco. And so Joe was this retired burlesque comedian. spent 30 years, among other things that he did, occult pursuits, but he spent 30 years in contact with Evans Wentz, who was the guy who was responsible for editing the first translation of the Tibetan Book of the Dead and these other translations, early Tibetan teachings through Oxford University starting in the 30s. So that's interesting because Joe was the guy who really actually could convey fundamental essence of mind and basically got us to really work with a really essential dharma. So that's, I didn't know when we were going around how to even bring this up, and then suddenly,
I know,
it's one of these kind of serendipitous things that's a funny one, though, because there were tons of people in San Francisco in those days, and that's enough.
Thank you. Wow. Okay.
Didn't know we'd end up here, but it's really good. Lovely.
Thank you.